when you're recording, you can start to think, okay, they will be listening to this. And you start creating for that other occasion, like for that moment when the other will listen. And it sometimes pulls you out of the moment itself, the moment of making music, that moment of surrender, of freedom, that freedom from error. Well, I should say not freedom from error, but freedom from the fear of errors, you know, and, you know, and freedom from the burden of perfection, you know. So I think it's the rare musician who can stay completely in that spot and at the same time, you know, have real freedom, you know. So the moment is more important, I think, than the musical perfection, you know. And the feeling of music, of course, is fundamentally what it's about. So you know, if you can capture that. But sometimes in the studio, you may have captured, and you might be in such a state of mind that you don't actually know if you captured it, you know.
Hi, you're listening to Conversations with Musicians with Leah Roseman. Martin Hayes is an internationally renowned Irish fiddler, beloved for his expressive playing and his collaborations with many great musicians in different genres, including Bill Frisell, Sting, Paul Simon, and more recently Yo-Yo Ma with the Silk Road Project. During this episode, we speak of his wonderful book, Shared Notes, and he plays some beautiful music live. You can always use the timestamps if you're curious to jump to some music right away, but I encourage you to listen through the whole episode. Martin speaks eloquently about life, culture, friendship, identity, and staying true to what you value. And I hope this episode will thrill lovers of Irish music and bring new listeners to many of Martin's projects, including the Common Ground Ensemble, The Gloaming, and many more. We talk about the loss and legacy of Dennis Cowell, how he met Thomas Bartlett, the rich depths of traditional music that Martin learned from the older generation, and the rhythm of life growing up on the farm in County Clare. Like all my episodes, this is available as both a video and a podcast on your favorite podcast platform, and the transcript is also linked in the description to my website, leahroseman.com. Hi, Martin Hayes. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Hi, Leah. Great to be here. Thank you.
I found out about you actually because of your book, your memoir, Shared Notes, which is such a beautifully written memoir. And I think it's one of my favorite books about music because it's so hard to write about music, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. In fact, that ended up being kind of a memoir as being the only vehicle by which I could actually write about it. It's not so easy to write just directly about music. But it turns out that, you know, maybe using the memoir model kind of gave me an opportunity, at least a good opportunity, to describe the whole background and setting to, you know, where I came in contact with music, how it all became part of my life. It was always part of my life, really, I suppose.
Should we maybe start with your dad? Maybe that'd be a good place to start.
Yeah. Well, his name was PJ Hayes. And But in his own neighborhood, he was known as P. Joe, you know, Patrick Joseph, you know, a lot of Patrick Josephs in Ireland. Anyway, he learned the fiddle when he was, I think he was 12, he was probably 13 or something like that before he started at all. And somebody had lent him a fiddle, or his family, and he took it up and tried it. And then he went to his neighbor, Paddy Kenny, who was like a couple of years older than him. And Paddy showed him a few things, and Paddy's dad, who was a kind of a local music teacher, also showed him things. So he kind of grew up learning with Paddy and playing with Paddy Kenny. And the two of them, they became kind of like this kind of like fiddling duet, you know, that would go here, there and everywhere. And they would play for local house dances. And then after a number of years, they found themselves in a Cayley band, the Tullagh Cayley band, which was a local Cayley band in County Clare at the time, back in 1946, I think that's when that started. So then they began to travel further afield, and there were competitions back then for Cayley bands and whatnot, and the Flacules started happening in Ireland some years later as well. And so, like, the Tullagh band was a big name in that kind of world. And my uncle Paddy Canny was quite a renowned fiddle player at the time. And somewhere like around 1959 then, you know, there was a lot of things. I'm leaping decades in rapid succession here, but they recorded an album along with their friend Peter O'Loughlin on flute. He was just on one side of the album, and another friend of theirs, Bridie Lafferty, a piano player who accompanied them on both sides of the album. Anyway, so that was like early in the years of LPs. It's reputedly the first long playing record of traditional music kind of recorded and produced in Ireland at the time. Before that, it was all 78s. And but there had been LPs of traditional music, obviously made in America, I think, before that. But anyway, so, and it was kind of a recording that a lot of people, like from Kevin Burke to Frankie Gavin, many other fiddle players would cite it as being kind of an influential record in their kind of musical background. But and it was actually ended up being a kind of an influential record for myself, even though I know both Paddy Canny and my father, you know. I still listen to the record and learn the tunes from the record, as it turns out. But anyway, that's my father. And he was like a farmer and a part-time musician, you know. So that was the most all traditional musicians, like up to that point, you know, were all either farmers or like carpenters, or like Tommy Potts was a fireman, you know, so there were various different professions, but almost nobody had a profession playing this music. So that was an unusual thing.
And when you played with the Tulla Cayley Band when you were older, I mean, you had to get home to milk the cows.
Yes, yeah, like Saturday night was always a busy night. Like we were always playing on Saturday nights. And we might be playing like up in Sligo or down in Kerry, from County Clare. In those times, it was more of a journey because the roads were small and narrow all the way. Yeah. And so we could get back at like 5 o'clock in the morning. And on Sunday mornings, the milk collection for the creamery was earlier than normal, so that everybody in the country would go to mass, you know, like so mass, the obligatory mass that everybody went to. So we would come home from the Cayley, and on occasions we just switched into like work clothes and went out and milked the cows without ever going to bed, and then we would go from there to mass and whatnot, and then like we'd try and get a few hours sleep in the afternoon. And sometimes we'd be headed out the door again that Sunday evening, like to play somewhere else. You know, it was quite common. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the way your dad taught you was just tunes from the beginning, just played a few notes.
That's correct, yeah. That was basically all that anybody did, really. They would just teach you tunes. And I mean, I didn't have other teachers, but from what I know of how it was passed on, it was very much, you know, you can see it, you can hear it, copy it, do what I'm doing, and mm-hmm. see how it works out. So in many ways, I think one of the interesting things about that is obviously it's not a very sophisticated learning model, but it does have a few things that are important about it. Like straight off, you're put in the position of being responsible, like no, there's no magic bullet. There's no solution that anybody has that will make this immediately easier for you. So you have to kind of navigate your way around the instrument yourself, and you have to learn about tone and intonation, and you have to learn about the use of the bow and how you're going to do that. So I think one of the things we see from that is that among Irish fiddlers, like, it's the enormous variety of approaches and the difference in sounds. Like, you know, the difference between Liz Carroll and Frankie Gavin and Kevin Burke and you name them. Like, they're as if they're playing different instruments almost, you know, the way in which they sound so different from each other. And I think that's probably one of the most fascinating things about this music is how distinctive and unique each musician ultimately is allowed to be, and in particular with the fiddle, you know. Hmm.
It's such an intricately melodic music. And I was thinking about, you seem to have a fabulous memory for the details of your life. It was really struck. And I encourage people to read your book. I mean, just even the whole part about going to the one room school and all the details of your childhood, it's cinematic. You bring it to life beautifully. Do you think you growing up that way and learning tunes that way sort of influenced the way you remembered your childhood and your life with all these details?
No, I don't think so. Because like to begin with, I don't have a particularly good memory, actually, as it turns out. Now, it might look different when you read the book. You think how, because most people think they can't remember the details of their lives. And I think that's largely due to the fact that we don't visit them very often. And the other thing is that it was something in my case, and I'm sure it might be the case for many others, is that we summarize parts of our life. Like, so I can tell you, I went to school in a one-room schoolhouse, and there was no running water, and we walked to school, and blah, blah, and I've told you the whole story. Now, of course, the story is much bigger than that. And like when I write it, like it's like pulling on a thread. I suddenly, okay, my God, okay, like, so once you start to investigate the story, so what I told you first was my heading. And we basically put our memories in boxes and we put a heading on it, you know, and a label, like, and there it is. And but we do actually remember a lot more. At least I was surprised myself at how much I actually remembered. And but the other thing is, I also was aware that, you know, in the first, you know, 10 years of my life, right, you know, from 62 to 72, that I was looking at a very old world in those early years, like a world where the farming was done with horse-drawn equipment, where there was a big open hearth fire in the kitchen, where, you know, so like it was like a lifestyle not greatly changed from medieval times almost. And then like modernity. And in the book, there's that moment when Neil Armstrong walks on the moon, and we in Ireland are aware of this, and we have grainy black and white televisions now, and we see a man landing on the moon. I knew that like the rest of my life was going to be in some kind of modernity. And that, no, maybe at that moment I didn't know that. But as the years went on, I realized, while I was an older teenager, I realized that I had witnessed something that, you know, was a way of life that would be unknown in very rapid time to all generations just immediately after me. And so I felt like it was important to remember this. And to take stock of it and not forget, almost in the same way that I felt about the music also, which was to take stock of what was around me locally, what music was making, you know, the richness of that musical life that surrounded me as a child. It felt like an important thing to hold on to preserve, to understand. Now, like I'm a real adventurer in music, but I'm still at heart also a bit of a preservationist and like a traditionalist in some respects, you know, I suppose. Okay.
Would you like to share a tune now, take a little music break and chat some more? Or
yeah,
would you like to
sure.
play later?
Why not? I'll grab my fiddle here while we're at it. Thank you.
so much. You know, I just had the joy of hearing you play that twice because you made a little mic adjustment. And yeah, of course, it was different. It's yeah, this beautiful, subtle things.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things, yeah, it's different every time I play. And so that's great some ways. But then if I actually want to play the same thing, I just can't. That's the other problem, you know, lack of consistency. But, you know, it's kind of, so I like the kind of, and I actually felt like I was cutting fairly close to the line there anyway, but, you know, but it's a kind of music, I suppose, where there's a certain amount of latitude, you know,
yeah,
inbuilt.
So the feel of the dance, the fact that you grew up playing with dancers really influenced you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's, I mean, the largest function that I saw that the music had when I was younger was that it was there for the dancer, you know. And now people like seem to have difficulty with the fact sometimes that like it can have many different functions, of course, you know, it doesn't have to be one function, it doesn't have to be just for dancers. So there was also a kind of a tradition of listening music, if we could call it that, you know, that I suppose like solo pipers and fiddle players like Tommy Potts and even Paddy Canny, I suppose, and people like Junior Crehan and Martin Rochford, and a lot of the musicians that I really liked were these kind of individual performers of the music. And their music was music that you sat and sometimes just closed your eyes and absorbed the experience of what they were relaying. And the other reality was a much more outward and alive kind of interaction with the things. So one of the things that was in my mind growing up was like to kind of bridge the gap, you know, to kind of like bring some of the vitality of the dance to the listening music and bring some of the lyricism of the listening music into the dance, as it were, you know. And so and oddly enough, my father was quite a rhythmic player and really would go in search of the pulse and the groove of the music. And my uncle Paddy Canny, though they had grown up learning and played together, was almost the opposite. He was like almost entirely lyrical in his approach and kind of, you know, like you could hear a narrative almost in his expression of melody. And it was all about, and so he was full of dynamics and whatnot. And it was not actually suitable for the dance at all. But when the two of them played together, it was kind of actually, it was as if like, you know, they were supplying each other with the missing part, you know, in each other's playing. So they kind of made a blueprint that I thought, could one person actually try to do this? You know, that was kind of part of my mission growing up. Like, would it be possible for me to, you know, take those two things and make them be a thing, you know?
Well, you certainly achieved that.
I don't know. I mean, I could show you a little bit of what I mean by that, you know?
Yeah.
You know, like we'll say in the playing of reels in particular, you know, you could have, you know, so like it could be like that. So it might be lyrical. Or it could be. So what I ended up doing was kind of bringing both of those things along. So I might end up playing like this. Thank you. So there's a bit of lyricism and a little bit of rhythm and groove in there. And I honestly don't even know what the tune is. I didn't know what I was going to play. So that just comes out, you know, just like wherever my fingers land, I suppose, whatever the first three notes are, that the first three notes are something. So you end up playing it, but that was it.
Do you always remember the names of tunes? I was curious about that.
No, I could be playing a tune and going, what on earth is that? Mm. What is that tune I'm playing? And not even know where I got it or what it is or anything. I'm not sure what that tune is called now that I just played. A certain amount of melodies, of course, I have. And if they regularly pop up in my performances and my concerts and my gigs, of course, I have the name ready at hand, you know, but there's another strata below that of melodies, just a big, big wash of them. And any of them could pop into awareness unnamed, you know, just like that, just like the one I played there, which is not a normal tune for me to play. But there you go.
Hi, just a quick break from the episode. I'm an independent podcaster who does all the many jobs required to produce this series, and there are a lot of costs I bear as well. Please consider either buying me a virtual coffee as a tip or becoming a monthly supporter starting at $3 Canadian, which is close to $2 US or 2 euros, and getting access to unique perks. The link is in the description. Now back to the episode.
There's something you wrote about recording which really resonated with me, and you wrote, the idea that we make music for another time can pull us away from making music for that very moment itself. The studio can be a horrible place. And you were referring, I think, to your first recording experiences and some of the older traditional musicians.
When you're recording, you can start to think, okay, they will be listening to this. And you start creating for that other occasion, like for that moment when the other will listen. And it sometimes pulls you out of the moment itself, the moment of making music, that moment of surrender, of freedom, that freedom from error. I should say not freedom from error, but freedom from the fear of errors, you know, and freedom from the burden of perfection, you know, because like trying to not make any mistake and play perfectly in the studio will push you out of the zone easily, I think. So I think it's the rare musician who can stay completely in that spot and at the same time, you know, have real freedom, you know. Mm-hmm. So the moment is more important, I think, than the musical perfection, you know. And the feeling of music, of course, is fundamentally what it's about. So you know, if you can capture that. But sometimes in the studio, you may have captured and you might be in such a state of mind that you don't actually know if you captured it, you know, because you're, you know, we can start like hearing a squawk on the fiddle, like, and not hearing the music anymore, you know.
Mm-hmm. Just this morning, I was listening to something, the Boynwater from your group, The Common Ground Ensemble.
All right, yeah.
Beautiful. And this ensemble, this recording you made was the beginning of lockdown, right?
Yeah. What happened was we had two concerts at the National Concert Hall in Dublin ready to go. And we were just meeting 2 days ahead. And we were just ready to go, and everything stopped. Of course, the concerts were all cancelled and everything. So we didn't talk for, well, what happened immediately after that was in the 2 days following that, or 3 days, I said, look, we're all here. Why don't we go into the studio and record what we got? And we did. Now, what you actually heard on this new recording isn't actually those recording sessions, because what we managed to capture on that occasion was basically everything we'd been working on, or like all of the pieces that we'd put together. We kind of at least recorded them in some fashion, more close enough to the arrangements we ended up with. But last summer was last spring and summer was the first time the band actually got to play in front of anybody. Mm-hmm. And so we did a few concerts, and like the band members just kind of lobbied me and said, is there any chance we could go back into the studio now that we've actually played a concert, you know, and we've actually had the live experience? Everyone said, we really know what we should be playing now, you know. And I go, all right, we'll go back in. So the arrangements didn't change enormously, but they did. We tightened up a lot of things, and we felt a lot more comfortable about it in the end.
So we'll talk some more about your many wonderful groups over the years, but this is a special, fairly new group. If you could speak to what you're doing with it.
Yeah, it's kind of the latest thing for me to do. Like every year, I work with the Kilkenny Arts Festival, which is a beautiful arts festival in Ireland every year, and I kind of help curate one section of that that has for many years involved me kind of creating a finale concert of all kinds of musicians and all kinds of things. So I've gotten into this idea of, you know, with short notice and little prep time, of pulling musicians together and creating bands and stuff like that. So I've done that at the Kilkenny Arts Festival. I do it at the Irish Arts Centre in New York. I do it as part of a festival that I curate in Bantry at the Masters of Tradition. And so I've been doing a lot of this over the years, and I've gotten to work with lots and lots of different musicians. And so this band is kind of like me saying, okay, like, well, you know, imagine what would I do if I had a little bit of time and I could just pull another collection of musicians together. So this is what it is. You know, it's kind of like my house band, you know, my kind of, you know, and it was also maybe the first time that I kind of ventured into, you know, choosing chords. Not that I wouldn't claim responsibility for all the cording on the album, but but the main harmonic trust of the album, I would say that I had a hand in that, and kind of just sat around here with a little MIDI keyboard and stuff like that, kind of making arrangements and stuff, you know, that I shared with musicians. Now, the intention was never that they would play exactly what I had done, but that I would give them, you know, enough material to work with and enough material to develop and to evolve from, and that I would, you know, begin a conversation on many different levels around the piece of music, and that they would have the freedom to bring their creativity to that and develop it into something much more, you know, refined and beautiful than I would have created myself. So that's kind of how the band works in a way, and that's what it is.
Okay. And are you, do you have big tours planned with them, or?
Well, I think next October we will be doing, you know, a good number of Irish dates and some UK dates, I think, and then, you know, we'll take it from there, you know. So we're just kind of getting the album out now and just seeing, you know, where it gets us. See who likes it and who wants it, you know.
Yeah, coming out of the pandemic, are you finding the performances are coming back for yourself?
Yeah, they are. You know, last spring it was still a bit shaky, but by the time we were into the summer, I could see that audiences, as far as I could see, were fully back. And so I felt like that by the end of the summer, we had kind of reached normality again. Now, I think a lot of people have changed what they do and how they do it and how much of what they want to do as a result of being through the pandemic. And I certainly got to spend a lot more time, you know, in a place than I had done for longer than I can remember, you know, for like 30 years. I hadn't actually stood still for that length, you know. And it was nice, and I enjoyed it. So I've kind of come out of the pandemic maybe. I mean, I continue to tour and play concerts, of course, but not at the same rate, I don't think. I think I want to do fewer concerts, but I want to put a lot more energy into them, and I want to kind of curate them and develop them and make each of them a little more special, I suppose, in some ways, you know. So that's the plan anyway.
Yeah, that's great. And on your YouTube channel, if people want to learn tunes from you, you have all these beautiful videos where you're teaching tunes.
Yeah, that's right. I that started during the pandemic. I mean, I have a Patreon website as well, where I teach, you know, some one-on-one classes, and I provide like actual kind of master classes once a month that I record as well. But I also felt during that time of the pandemic that, you know, I should, apart from that, like also just see if I could put music and tunes in the hands of people, because never was there a time when people had so much time on their hands to learn new tunes with the fiddle. So I thought, well, you know, we'll give something away as well, and we let other people contribute as well. You know, so it was kind of a decision to, you know, why not? You know, that everything shouldn't be charged for, you know.
Yeah.
Some stuff should be free.
I ended up working with some adults who hadn't played since they were children, and it was a beautiful thing, you know, that because of being home alone, they are just not necessarily alone, but just having this time, they went back to the violin.
Yeah, I think so. I think people discovered a lot of things like that during the pandemic. I think in my own case, I kind of, the first part of the pandemic, my wife and I were in northern Spain in Asturias, and out in the countryside, in a beautiful area. And, you know, I saw the buds come in the trees. I saw the leaves emerge. I saw the flowers emerge. I saw the fruit emerge. You know, I saw the grass grow. I saw the weather change. I saw, you know, in a way that I hadn't witnessed in a long time. And I also realized how, like, there were elemental things like being in nature. Like really nurturing when you let yourself be there for a good period, and it changes how you feel and think. And so there was a lot of, it was, life was about nature. It was about, you know, building a fire in the evening and sitting in front of a fireplace. And it was about, you know, having meals and sometimes sitting outside and just looking at the mountain and hearing the breeze and letting the river flow by. And, you know, I thought, boy, okay, maybe I need to do more of this, you know.
Yeah, I think many of us had similar experiences.
Yeah.
Would you like to play another tune? And then we have a big topic coming. I think we should talk about your friend Dennis.
We have a big topic? Okay. All right, I'd better play something. So let me see. Thank you.
you. Do you remember the name of that tune?
Yeah, I do. That one is called The Glen of Aherlow.
Okay. And
it was written by a fiddle player. He would have been a friend of my father's in Paddy Kenny's, a man from Tipperary by the name of Sean Ryan. He actually wrote the first two jigs I played as well, just coincidentally. So.
Okay. I'm curious, do you sometimes use alternate tunings on your violin?
I haven't, no. I just stay in the regular tuning. Now, I mean, there have been instances of alternate tunings happening in Irish music, and but not as common as in American old-timey music, for example. You know, so we do have some examples of it, but not very many.
Yeah.
Not like the American tradition.
Yeah. So I just saw the beautiful tribute to Dennis Cowell that was made, and I can link that directly to this episode.
Okay. Yeah, that was, I entered the pandemic chatting to Dennis, and after the pandemic, he was no longer there, you know. It was, we were very, very close friends, you know, for a very, very long time. And we have a huge amount of, you know, shared experience, I suppose. So, even I look back at it now, I go like, God, this is unimaginable. Like, I mean, for me, in a way, you know, it's difficult to... I never thought about how would our duet end? Like how does this, you know, like it didn't seem like it ever would have an end, you know, and there you go, you know. So, but you know, he was like a fabulous musician and a great musical partner for me over the years. I mean, we've had like you know, just such a great experience, like. We traveled together to every corner of the globe, you know, and had a great time. Understood each other, I think, and just, you know. One thing I know for sure was that he appreciated it. Like he didn't. I mean, we can all get tired and exhausted touring and traveling, and sometimes airports just get to be a bit much. But even so. The fact that we were out there touring and playing music, he was always aware that this doesn't happen for everybody, and this actually we're in the lucky minority of people who get to do this in this way, and he was always really, really, I think, carried a sense of gratefulness for that. You know, mm-hmm. he never lost that.
Yeah, and he became part of your family. It wasn't just a musical.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, he spent almost all his summers on our family farm back in County Clare, and like lots of other times during the year as well. It wasn't just the summer. And, you know, he became friends with my sisters and my brother, with my father and mother when they were alive. And he, you know, and they kind of took him in like he was a son, you know. So he kind of had that relationship, you know. He sat around the Sunday table with us regularly, and to the point, you know, where he was company, but he wasn't, he like the same conversation happened around the table with him as without him, you know. Mm-hmm. So he was very much, you know, inside our reality, I think, as a human being. So he was in our family, really. Part of our family, I should say.
Do you find yourself sort of talking to him now?
Every now and again, I do, yeah. I do. I don't know if he can hear me. I think he'd be fascinated with the amount of attention he was getting, you know, afterwards. But he deserved it, you know. I think.
So when you met him, he was a jobbing guitarist playing all kinds of styles, playing.
He didn't have much. Like involvement with traditional music, and he was just playing these kind of bars and cabaret clubs and stuff like that of Chicago. And he had, you know, played in country bars with country bands. He had played in disco bands. He had played in top 40 bands. He had played classical music. He had kind of been part of that earlier you know, folk scene, singer-songwriter folk scene of Chicago, like from the mid-70s, I suppose, you know. And, you know, so he had a fairly diverse background. He was just, and no matter what happened, whatever kind of music it was, he was going to be playing music, you know, and he was going to do gigs. That was just his life, you know. And he was, you know, whereas I was by no means sure I was going to be a full-time musician. He was dedicated to this idea from early teenage years, you know. So he, you know, he lived it then.
But do you think because he grew up in Chicago, there was a cultural difference in terms of expectation?
Yeah, there was a cultural difference. I mean, it seemed ridiculous to me to even consider a career as a musician, you know, because like all of the musicians I had known, none of them had this as a career. Mm-hmm. And Dennis, of course, you know, living in America in those times, he could imagine his life as a musician. Like, so he had that quite clear from the beginning. Now, I should say, like, even though I never planned being a professional musician, music was still the central part of my life. And it was like core to my identity, I think, and everything. And it was the central passion that that could animate me in a way that nothing else could, you know. So music, whether I made a living or not, was going to be a central part of my life. And for Dennis, like, he had made that decision earlier on and he never really wavered from that, you know.
In terms of the Irish diaspora and the Irish community in the States, was it interesting to you when you emigrated? You lived in the States for a very long time.
Yeah. I lived in America for like 26 years. I think, I mean, like the diaspora, the Irish diaspora of Chicago was like a complex, multi-level layered thing. I mean, you have, like on St. Patrick's Day, you had a whole range of Irish, like, you know, they were barely Irish at all in any sense. And then there were the old Irish Americans. There was like, you know, old families going way back into the past, long history of Irishness, if you want to call it that. And then there was like the wave of immigrants from the 40s and 50s and 60s even, like that were in Chicago, mm-hmm. that were all, you know, established families with, you know, children going to college, and yet they were Irish and connected. And then in the 80s, when I came, there was another wave of young immigrants again. So there were a whole lot of people my age. And all of those sections of the diaspora listened to different kinds of music. All of them had a different sense of what being Irish was, and had different kind of, I suppose you could say, stereotypes of what all that was. So it was like there was no one Irish thing. Mm-hmm. That's what I began to realize, you know, and that there was that it was like a pretty broad spectrum of, you know, cultural experiences and expectations, you know, right across all of those kinds of, you know, versions of being Irish in America, you know.
Mm-hmm. One thing I took note of, the Irish Musicians Association in Chicago, that the former police chief Francis O'Neill had written all these transcriptions of traditional music.
Yeah, that, like, Chicago was where the biggest and most influential collection of Irish music was ever made, really. So O'Neill's 1001 Irish dance tunes collected in primarily in Chicago, like, is kind of a musical Bible in a way, you know. And so there were like traditional musicians going all the way back into the past. I'm going to grab a little book that was written by somebody about Chicago.
Wonderful.
Just recently, and it's a big book here called Cry of a People Gone. Is that correct? Does that look all right?
Yes, and then it says Irish Musicians in Chicago, 1920 to 2020.
That's right, yeah, that's right. It was written, it just came out, and it's written by Richie Piggott. And it's like all of the musicians that I'd ever known in Chicago when I first arrived there. they're all covered in this book. It's quite a big gathering of that. But yes, Chicago, I'm going way back, mm-hmm. seemed to have that collection of musicians. Like, you know, it was just a big city for that, you know.
But for yourself, in Ireland, you'd won the All-Ireland Fiddle Championship, what, many, many times, and you were known in your community. And then you went there and people didn't know who you were, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the Irish musicians did, like some of the, like yeah. there were a handful, like, but yeah, I mean, basically I had to kind of start at the first rung again, you know, like establish myself bit by bit. You know? America is a great place for reinvention, you know, but it's also a place that doesn't care what happened anywhere else. Like you come here and make it on your own, start from, you know, you're free to do it. Like, so yes, I felt like I had to, you know, just start all over, you know, mm-hmm. in that sense, you know, make a name for myself, you know, find a career path, find a way through this, you know. And so, like, I think if I hadn't been in America, I don't think I would have a career, to tell you the truth, because there is something about the rough and tumble of the US, and it's kind of an unforgiving place, but it's also an incredibly free place. Mm. And you know, I was able to kind of, you know, build a very small little career at first, you know, that gradually sustained me. And yeah, I don't know if I'd have been able to do that as easily anywhere else. I mean, I think you could now, but mm-hmm. but back then it wasn't as easy, you know.
Yeah. So you were playing a lot of bars, you were playing music that wasn't close to your heart, but it was what people wanted to hear.
Yeah, I mean, that's the eternal, like, paradox that musicians will have to face up to, like, at some point, you know, which is like, you know, like, are you going to be an entertainer? And does that by its nature say, well, what does the audience want? And let us figure out what they want and give it to them, you know? And of course, that makes perfect sense if you're a corporation selling a product, you know, or if you're a company wanting to market a service, you should go and find out what people want and design the product, the best product you can for them to fulfill this need. But music, like, I mean, you can do that with music too, and it does get done, but music has a deeper level of reality also, which is that it's what's in one's soul. It's what's in one's soul and heart that needs to connect with another soul and heart, you know, that needs to transform, needs to communicate a deeper truth, a deeper beauty, bring people together in a meaningful experience. Well, that's not test marketable, you know. That's a different kind of quality of experience, and in some ways, that experience is at odds with the quote unquote market, you know. So, at first, I didn't know what I was doing. I was playing what the audiences wanted, and ultimately, it seemed to me not to be so important what I wanted. You know, I just do what they want. You know, why should I be concerned about me? But of course, if you have something deeper within you and you don't honor that and you don't respect that call, it does eat you up gradually. And it kind of becomes quite painful in the end. You know, you're dishonoring something. You're dishonoring yourself in reality, but also maybe in my case, dishonoring a tradition or dishonoring, you know, something that I know is much deeper, much more real, much more powerful, you know. And so, like, you know, that just, like, I could only handle so much of that, and then as the book testifies, like, I explode, you know. But I had this conversation, and I think I wrote about it in the book as well, about what one should do in respect to that quagmire of, like, doing what the audience wants and doing what's in your own heart. And it was this man, Norman was his name, said, Well, you should play what you want to play, what you love, what's meaningful and deep to you. But you should play it to the audience with an intention of sharing and giving. And you should recognize that the stage is a sacred place, a space where you've been empowered to be truthful, to be real, to be honest, to have integrity. So those ideas became very important to me, and I became reliant on them, you know, in a sense, and then decided maybe I should just trust that kind of process and see if it would bring me to somewhere meaningful, you know. And so in a sense, like once I gradually figured that out, I was able to take a journey that was a little more courageous and a little more deep and truthful, I think, you know.
Mm-hmm. And your breaking point in 1988, that's not the same fiddle that you're holding.
No, it's not. No.
Yeah.
But that fiddle is happily fully intact and functional and works fine. I just don't have it here with me now, but
yeah.
it's a good fiddle, and we put it all back together again.
Well, maybe we should talk a little bit about Thomas Bartlett and the gloaming. That's an incredible story, really. And actually, I was just thinking of that, the story when you first went back to Ireland. You weren't able to return for a number of years because of your immigration status. And I was really touched that you were playing in a place and people were talking. And then you offered to give them their money back if they would just leave. I love that.
Yeah. Well, it was because the thing was like, the point was, I don't want a gig at all at any cost. Like I want to do a thing. I'm very happy to have a gig, but I want to make something of an experience. I want to create something real, and so I was, in my own mind, it was important to me to say that, you know, you won't be able to pay me enough to go against that, you know, like, I kind of made a decision that there are some kind of lines in the sand. You know, they talk a lot about lines in the sand, but of course, like, if you put a line in the sand, you're going to have to actually stick with it. Now, you're actually, it's not a line unless you actually respond. Mm-hmm. Like, so for me, telling the audience that, you know, I don't really want to sit up here on the stage and just kind of mumble through tunes here and just make some, you know, backdrop. Now, if I had a gig that and they told me I just want to play ambient music in the back, I think I'd be okay with that, actually. The problem was that's not what the concert was. That we were trying to make something else, and that was the purpose, and I couldn't. So I did offer the audience their money back. And I think the next night I offered them again at another venue the money back as well. And you know what? After that, I never had to do that again. That was it. Like, people used to, and for that day, people like often would say, well, now, you know, sometimes audiences will be talking and stuff like that. Or do they talk when you're playing? I'm going, no, never. They don't. Like, I'm going to browbeat an audience into being quiet. Like, they just know. Like, they just know I'd probably walk away. Yeah, you know, I would too. Not in anger. I would just go, okay, this is not going to work. So, well, let's leave it. Like.
So I interrupted myself asking you about Thomas Bartlett.
Sorry. That's okay, yeah. Yeah, I remember touring in Ireland with Steve Cooney. I think it was maybe after the fourth album was out, and we were just traveling around, and we played a bunch of gigs. We played a gig in Dublin and played a lot of other gigs. And I guess young Thomas Bartlett, like, who was like 9 or 10 or something like that, was with his parents, and they were on their way to Nepal. But he had an interest in Irish music and stuff. And so they stopped in Ireland for like a week or two or something like that on this trek to Nepal, you know, from Vermont. And I think he saw in Time Out magazine that we were actually playing somewhere that Steve Cooney and I were playing. He said he convinced his parents that they needed to take him there, you know. So he came to the concert. And shortly after that, we had a whole series of gigs. And then Thomas started turning up at all these gigs, and he was in the front row with his parents. And like after a few nights, you know, I go, I better talk to these people. Like, they seem to be everywhere. So what happened was that they didn't have any other immediate plans made, and they just decided, you know, we'll just go where Steve and Martin are going on the tour, and we'll just follow them around and go to the concerts and see where that takes us. So I know that it took us to Derry on the night of the IRA ceasefire, which was kind of a monumental moment in time in Irish politics and history, you know, because it was essentially the end of the strife, you know. It was at least the beginning of the end of it, you know, and a significant step towards where we are now in the peace process. But young Thomas was there that night, and I did speak to them. And as Thomas later said, like, I didn't think you'd ever remember, you know, or that, like, and I probably didn't actually, but I had to be reminded later. But if we can dial forward then, like a few years later, I'm back in Seattle, and an email comes in, and I didn't recognize the name, or nobody did. It was a Thomas Bartlett asking if we ever performed in Vermont. And we wrote back saying, well, we'd be happy to perform in Vermont. Is there somebody you know that puts on concerts, and is there somebody we should contact, or what have you? And then another email returned saying, yeah, in fact, are you free this particular date? And we gave a date. We said, yeah. And then the next thing, like, we were booked, I guess, to play a concert. And everything was going really well. And the communications are going, and we think everything is normal. And then we email back asking if somebody could pick us up from a train station, I think it was. And then the response came back, well, I'll have to ask my mom. And then we realized, who the hell is promoting this gig? Like, we booked by a kid. And we were booked by Thomas. So Thomas Bartlett is like, goes on years later to be a very successful kind of studio musician, touring musician with bands like The National and Yoko Ono and David Byrne and, oh, you name it. Like, he's a serious New York musician in a way, you know, and went on to become the piano player in a band that I played in for a number of years, The Gloaming. And anyway, so, but it all started with that young kid in Derry, and then the concert in Vermont. I met Sam Amidon as well. Sam was a friend of Thomas's, and Sam was up in Vermont as well. So, and I still see Sam, you know, and he has got a great career going as well. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's the story of Thomas Bartlett and how I got to know him.
It's an incredible story. I think I heard him in an interview talking about that he had your first album that he'd been listening to a lot.
So yeah, that's right. Yeah. So that's like that straight off. Like, that's an unusual 10-year-old, you know, it's a normal 10-year-old. Like, I didn't think I had a lot of fans in that age group, you know, but anyway, I did have one for sure.
But you were the same when you were young, because you were listening to music that your peers weren't listening to.
Yeah. I was a bit off center myself, I suppose, in what I liked to do, what I thought was important musically, and, you know, yeah. So I was musically old before my time, you know, and very into like obscure ways of playing and enjoying the company of older people and their musical ideas, and feeling quite connected with them, and feeling like I could understand them, and also feeling like understood by them, you know. So that was all very important to me, you know.
Yeah. Growing up. So The Gloaming was a very successful band, toured big venues all over. You played major halls like Carnegie and
Yeah, but it, yeah. Well, I mean, you just never know, really, with these things. It's successful, but it's not like, you know, we're not pop rock and roll success. You know, this is not U2 here, but in this world of traditional music, it was like, for that world, it was quite successful, I suppose. And in a way that we hadn't anticipated. And sometimes I wonder, like, when I was putting that band together, did I have any idea about anything? I didn't really. I had no plan about where we're going or where it could end up or what it could be. I had not a foggiest notion. I didn't, like, it might have ended up, like, it might have lasted a year or 6 months, or it might have made a record, it might have not. You know, I didn't know, you know, how far we could get with any of this, like, you know, or where it would end up. So it was a very, lucky and happy surprise for us, you know, that it just caught on. And it just caught on. I don't know why. I don't know how, even.
Well, Dennis was at the core of that with you.
Yeah, Dennis was at the core of most of my projects. Like, he kind of came with me in most of the collaborations I did. You know, there were a few exceptions, of course, but Dennis was either with me in the band or as a duet or as, like, part of this other quartet that we had, or, you know, like, all kinds of other touring things that we'd done over the years. Like, Dennis and I would be kind of a little unit in the middle of all of these collaborations, you know. So he was kind of, he was a big part of all of this. And I think he was a big part for Thomas as well, in terms of Thomas's own ideas about, like, what kind of chords to use with these tunes and what kind of approaches could be taken, you know. So I think maybe the stuff that Dennis and I did on the fourth album we made together, which was The Lonesome Touch, I think that had a lot of resonance for Thomas, I think, as well, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting about choices of harmony, because it's not very harmonic music traditionally. It's sort of
There's no harmony available at all that we know of.
Yeah,
it's wide open.
Yeah,
and I go, wide open means, like, lots of opportunity as far as I'm concerned, and I don't feel like that the idea of accompaniment to traditional music in Irish music, or the harmonic envelope that we use, is by no means a closed book. And I think it's all up for grabs still, you know. And I think that's, you know, so, you know, we're at, you know, when you look at our ancient harp music, there are no harmonic lines with it, you know. There's no chords, there's no sense of what might have been used. Mm-hmm. But you can guess, and you can kind of make a good estimate of what they might have played. So that would feel like a loss in a certain way that we didn't have it. But it's also a kind of a gain too, in the, like, you know, if you're listening to early Baroque music, for example, like Marin Marais or something like that, it's there. It's all written. It's, you know, you don't get to create anything different there, really, in a fundamental way. Whereas with our music, seems to be unlimited freedom to, you know, reimagine that and to kind of, you know, put the music in a 21st century harmonic world as well. There's no law against it. I mean, the only law against it would be is if it destroys the feeling of the music or if it undermines what's inherently valuable in it, then I think you are making a mistake. But if you don't sabotage the music in that way, you know, I think there's a big, big open world of possibility there in front of us, you know.
I was listening to some of your Martin Hayes Quartet with, what's her name?
Liz Knowles.
Liz Knowles, yeah. So she seemed to be playing the viola d'amore.
Yeah, it's kind of like a five-string fiddle with you know, a larger body, so it's a bit like a viola, and it's also got, like, the other part of it is the Norwegian hardanger, kind of
resonative
resonant sympathetic strings. So there are a handful of those instruments out there, and I like I've worked with a good few people who play that instrument, as rare and all as it is. Like in the gloaming, Quivian O'Reilly played one of them, and in the quartet, Liz Knowles. Now, when I was setting up the quartet, I didn't realize Liz had one of those instruments, so I had actually asked her as a violist, you know, and which was grand. And but then halfway through, she goes, "Now you know, I have one of these things. You know those instruments." I go, "Oh, like Quivian." She goes, "Would you mind if I brought that instead?" I go, "Sure, what the hell, you know?" So anyway, you know, I get to go from having it in the gloaming to having it in the quartet as well. You know, it's an unusual instrument, but it stands as a lovely kind of counterpoint to the actual fiddle as well. You know, they're quite different sounds, and they create different kind of textural opportunities, I suppose, you know.
Mm-hmm. Have you tried a 5 or 6 string like electric violin yourself, just out of curiosity?
Yeah, in my younger days, I had a 5-string white Zeta electric fiddle. I don't know. I used to just hit that C string every now and again. Like I didn't really utilize it. And in truth, I didn't have a great time playing electric fiddle. I just found it kind of like a bit disconnected and woolly and not detailed in the way that I like things to be, you know. So I was missing that kind of, you know, engagement with wood and strings in a way that, like, you can't with electric sound, you know. So it was good when the band was very loud, of course, but in reality, I just, there was detailing I couldn't ever get out of the electric fiddle.
Yeah. And did you find the feeling was different because there wasn't the vibration, you know, against your body?
Yes, because you're not hearing it here. You're not hearing it up through your jawbone in the same way. You're like, and you're hearing it out of an amp down here on the floor. And I go, "Oh my God, like, you know, if I turn my head, my fiddle disappears." I'm like, I found it difficult. I'll be honest. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And the Irish language, you didn't grow up with it. Have you learned some as an adult?
We learned it going to school.
Okay.
And I suppose Ireland is famous for its Irish language education, in that everybody studied it, everybody read it, and then nobody spoke it. You know, well, some people did, but not very many of us. We were very good at reading and writing this, you know, and they didn't really teach us basic conversation, you know. So we had this, you know, I could read like real books, you know, and do that, and yet we didn't speak among ourselves in Irish, so it kind of like I still have a good chunk of Irish in my head, but my God, you know, like it's not ready at my disposal when I want to speak, you know, so I would be kind of tongue tied and slow. In an Irish language conversation, but you know, it's a rich language too, I think there's something very beautiful about it, and it's on my to-do list of things to get fluent in, you know, instead of, you know, reading and writing it, like, which was, you know, that was the thing we didn't need to do, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I knew the newer generation was studying. I didn't realize that your generation also.
Yeah.
In that tribute to Dennis, a lot of it is in Irish. And when I was watching it with my husband, we realized we needed the subtitles.
I said to Donald, the producer, I had a moment when I thought, you know, I should try and speak Irish now. But then I go, I wouldn't have had the freedom to speak as I did, you know, like I wouldn't be able to speak with the same freedom and stuff. So I abandoned the idea. Yeah. I probably would have had to abandon it anyway, you know.
And have you learned Spanish?
Yeah, I have a bit. I think I'm famously bad at languages. This is the conclusion I'm coming to, you know, that I'm not good with languages, but maybe I'm leaving it too late in life to get serious about them. But I enjoy it though. I kind of keep studying the Spanish. You have to keep kind of engaging with it, but I do enjoy it, I have to say.
There's a part of Spain that has a Celtic connection, right? And
The north of Spain is facing the Atlantic up there. Is a largely Celtic, especially from Asturias on over towards Galicia. The sound of Spain there is the sound of pipes. Mm-hmm. And the sound of Spain in the south, of course, is flamenco and whatnot. But in the north, it's the pipes. And, you know, so my wife's family are from up there, so they relate to the piping. They relate mm-hmm. to that sound, you know. And so, and people up there would regard themselves as being Celtic, largely.
Mm-hmm. Have you learned any of that music?
I haven't, no. I tend to kind of... Yeah, I haven't. I haven't really, like, for example, learned Cape Breton music or mm-hmm. Breton music or Scottish music. Or I stay, you know, it's like I stay away from the close relatives. You know, like it's kind of something about interbreeding there that I think, you know, like there's not that much separating us. Let's see if we can keep things still in their files. You know. Mm-hmm. That, well, I could be wrong, but that's I kind of think like that, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, like what would you gain from merging Irish and Scottish music except to blur whatever distinctions already exist, I suppose, you know. Because we're essentially the same music, like Irish and Scottish music. We're just simply dialects of each other, you know. Mm-hmm. And I suppose to a greater degree that's true with... you know, Breton music as well, you know, and, you know, it's great music. I love it. I haven't really thought about, like, putting my energy into learning any of those music. Now, that's not to say that I don't enjoy them and like them. I do, for sure. Mm-hmm. But I still feel, you know, there's so many thousands of Irish tunes.
Yeah,
and I have a to-do list of tunes I want to learn still, like in this music, like okay. So. It's not like I'm going, I need to go somewhere else and find new tunes. I don't, you know. I just have so many I want to learn and play here that I'm still like, will never run out of material, I suppose.
We talked briefly before about, you know, asserting yourself as a performer to make sure people were listening. I also like the story you told about the St. Patrick's luncheon on Capitol Hill, where you played for Obama and other dignitaries, that you researched before, that you'd seen videos and you thought, I don't want to be playing while they're eating lunch. I don't, yeah. You know, I want to make sure that they pay attention.
Yeah, well, I want the thing to, I didn't want to play there as some kind of token.
Yeah,
or you know, just you know, like they're ticking a box. Put the Irish music in the corner. Mm-hmm. Give me the, you know, the shamrocks and the beer, and we'll celebrate St. Patrick and stuff like that. I kind of like when I got asked to do it, like, you know, quite arrogantly asking the White House, you know, kind of social secretary and stuff like that. You know, well, we'd like a little stage. We'd like the PA here. We'd like this. We'd like that. We'd like to play for this. How long can we play? You know, we didn't get to control all the mm-hmm. the details of this, obviously. But yeah, I kind of said, like, I want this to be a real thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So they did. They set it up kind of the way we wanted and liked. And then when that, like, we had like 15 or 20 minutes or something like that, I said to Dennis, you know, let's go for it. Like, let's go for this as if this was a very, very real gig, you know. Let's not kind of just start. This is not the moment to start pandering to the audience here, you know, mm-hmm. and to start giving them what I think they might want to hear, or assuming that they wouldn't be able to understand what I wanted to play, or that it might be too esoteric or whatnot. So I ignored all of that and decided to play it as if this was a very real gig, a very normal gig for me. And so I dug in deep and played like slow air as deep as I could, you know, played with as much passion and feeling as I could. And you know what? Like I ended up like feeling like I made a connection with people like Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama. They all seem to really, really connect and enjoy it, you know? And so that was a very, a heartening experience, you know, that like I felt like I was able to reach them musically, you know. Mm-hmm. That was important, you know, that it wasn't just kind of just wheeling the Irish music here and like have some kind of tokenism, you know. I'm glad we didn't have that experience, you know.
With the traditional airs, I'm speaking from complete ignorance about Irish music, are they generally vocal songs that are used instrumentally?
Yeah, but not all. Some of them don't have lyrics. And there's a kind of, you could say, they're kind of free form, you know, they're flexible, they're not stuck to any rigid, like the old Shano singing of the west of Ireland, Connemara, is like very free, quite ornamented, very deeply rooted in feeling and passion, and the phrase of the song is shaped by feeling, you know. And so when we play, like Ilan Pipers would be important people in terms of, you know, showing the potential in these airs and stuff. And the singing tradition for me would be very important in me, you know, understanding how to express these tunes, you know, because, like, you know, because when I play, there's a kind of a vocal framework in my mind, you know. I try to gesture and use the dynamics of a singer. I try to sing or play a phrase that would be breathable, like that would actually make sense if you try to sing. And so those are the kind of things that are, you know, in my thinking when I'm playing airs, you know.
Would you be willing to play an air?
Sure, of course, yeah. So that's a tune called A Stourmochree. It's an old air, and it has lyrics. And this one actually has lyrics in the English language, but many of them are in the Irish language. This one is about written from the perspective of the people left behind in immigration story, you know, and a kind of an appeal to those leaving to not forget, to not be dazzled, to not lose their connection to who they are, where they come from, to not lose that, you know, in a way, and to not forget the people behind and the life they left, you know, because there are many aspects of the immigrant story, you know. There's the, you know, the loss. I mean, there's a lot gained when people arrive in these countries, of course, but there's a lot lost as well. And there's kind of often a lot of pain involved with that. There's the pain of parents who will never see children again, you know. And they used to have this thing, I mean, it's obviously not the same anymore, but they used to have the American wake. Did you ever hear of that?
No.
It was like a party, but it was like a wake. It was like a death. It was like a funeral.
Okay.
And they would have the American wake, as they called it, for the people leaving for America. So all the neighbors would come. Mm. The music would happen, the party. It was kind of a party, but it was also filled with a tinge of sadness. You know, it was like, you know, X amount of people were going to be lost. And many of the people who would have left in those earlier years, perhaps in the 19th century, would never again return. They would never again see their parents. They would never, like, they wouldn't be there to witness their parents' funerals. They wouldn't, you know, they would never, ever again see that. So, like, no matter what bounty the other side held, there was still that flip side of reality for the immigrants, I think, you know. That, you know, I think in America, like, that part of it was, we just kind of brushed it aside, like, and go, we're in the land of, you know, the brave and the powerful and the freedom. And that's also true, of course, you know. There's no question that that's also, but any immigrant will tell you that there was a deeper sadness as well carried within them. You know, there was a pain, there was a big price to pay for that too.
Yeah. I mean, I'm Canadian and my grandparents were immigrants, but even my parents being children of immigrants, like you carry that with you. And for the Jewish community, I mean, there wasn't anything to go back to either.
That's right. Yeah. The homeland was gone in many cases. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, it's very, very, like that, like place and connection and stuff like that are very important to the human spirit and psyche, you know, and losing that's a big trauma, you know, and like you can tell from Irish-American culture the degree to which people held on to this, like, and the affection that was deep-rooted across generations, you know. And of course, it's the very same for Jewish and Italian and you name it, whatever immigrants arrived in the New World. That was going to be that story as well.
And now, I mean, a lot of immigrants can't afford to return, or not often, you know, even though we have.
Yeah, of course, yeah, it's flights. Still going on, you know. I mean, like, you know, we're in different societies and parts of culture where that's largely behind us now. But yes, of course, for all the migrant people in the world now and all the homeless people from Ukraine, from you name it, like it's a painful reality, a human painful reality that keeps seemingly repeating itself. And it's very sad, you know. It's a lot of pain there, you know.
Yeah. When for yourself, when you're having those dark days in Chicago and you're feeling that disconnect and you couldn't go back, you know, for a while, did the music that mean the most to you, were you playing it for yourself, even if you weren't playing it at your gigs?
Oh, I would, yeah. Like, you know, I would be playing sessions and stuff in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I think maybe at the end of the night when there'd be two or three musicians left, I would often just take up the fiddle and kind of go a little deeper, you know. Mm-hmm. And go into that experience, like that part of home that had come with me, you know, that part of my early life that I brought to America inside of myself, you know. I would kind of release that every now and again, you know. I mean, I didn't think I could ever utilize that part of who I was musically as a career, like that seemed like implausible, like but I would do it every now and again, and I would try and do it when I was in the company of good friends and musicians who could feel and sense what I was trying to say musically. So I kept the flame going anyway. You know, I didn't ever let that die out completely, no matter what other things I was doing, whether I was in a rock and roll band or whatever I was doing. I still would come back and have a taste of that, you know, on a fairly regular basis.
Now, we started this conversation with your dad teaching you fiddle. And I remember from your book saying that after about 3 years, he said to you gently, well, maybe you should just give up because you weren't making enough progress.
Yeah. I'm sure it was a painful thing for him to have to say, like, but it didn't look like I had any real flair for this at all. Like, you know, I wasn't making any real progress, you know. And I suppose he was getting exhausted from teaching me some of the same tunes over and over, you know, and like wondering, am I going? And like, I'd say he was kind of thinking, like, you know, to himself, he didn't want to be driven crazy trying to teach somebody who wasn't going to like make any progress. Like, so, so he's gone, I'll give you a get out of jail card here. I'll let you off the hook, you know. You're free to go and do something else if that's what you want to do. So probably a lot of kids would have kind of taken that pass, you know, and say, I'm out of here, you know. But the problem was I had actually begun to identify with this. I had begun to see myself as this fiddle player and begun to value it as an important part of my life. Now, the question was, like, you know, I valued it. I did a lot of things, but I wasn't working, you know. I wasn't like pushing through, you know. And but when my father showed that like seemingly very honest lack of belief and faith, I kind of go, oh my God, you know, he doesn't think I can do it. Oh my God, I better knuckle down, you know. And I did, you know. And I did. So, like, whenever something in my life, whenever music was under threat or whenever there was any sense that the music for me might not continue or something, I would suddenly give it this massive priority. Like I wouldn't let anything get in the way of it, you know?
Yeah.
And all through my life, I've kind of, like protected the music in my life that way, you know? Like I wouldn't take any job or career or go anywhere or do anything that would ultimately undermine the making of music, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That just, like, there was something deep there that makes me not cross that line, if that makes any sense, you know.
Mm-hmm. You wrote about one of your very early experiences playing with Mary McNamara, and you said, we landed in this perfectly comfortable, you know, place, and that after that you, I'm not quoting you directly here, but that you aspire to that feeling.
Yeah, it was like, it was a competition, you know, and like in the Flag Hills, back in those days, you had to compete at the county level, right? And then, you know, in County Clare, you would go on to the Munster competition and compete there, and then if you got in fourth or second, I think, you could go on to the All-Ireland competition, you know. So Mary and I were in the, well, what were we actually in, the adult or under 18? I'm not quite sure. It might have been under 18 or adult. I can't quite remember that now, but in either case, anyway, Mary sprained her ankle at the county Flag Hill, and so she was in bad form. She wasn't up for playing, but we played anyway, you know. And they adjudicated her. Yeah, so bad. We'll let them go. You know, we'll give them a pass to the Munster. So we got to the Munster, and we were late for the competition. We just barely got in the door. It was on, and we were flustered and rushed. But we just kind of got through that, and like in second place. So if you were like going to the races and you were betting on a horse and you were seeing the form, you know, and you go like, oh, they came in here, they came. You'd look at Mary and I going into this competition, you'd say, I would place money that they won't win this, you know, because it didn't look good. Anyhow, just the background to the story. So I suppose the point was, when we got up to play that competition, we didn't care anymore. We weren't actually, like, we didn't even think about winning or care or nothing, you know. And we started to play, and instead of thinking about the competition or thinking about anything else, like, we just started connecting musically. And then I felt us connecting with the audience, with the room, with the people. And the groove was just exactly right. The tempo was right. The everything felt right. Like, we felt like we could kind of read each other's playing. And it just turned into just exactly the kind of music we wanted to play deep down, you know. And I always thought, and we did end up, of course, winning the competition then. But like, we weren't entering it with a very competitive mindset, I don't think. But there was just that experience in the room, that feeling of the room transforming as you played, like as the feeling in the room becoming a palpable thing, you know, and the feeling of connection, the connection between Mary and myself playing, and between the feeling in the room, the audience in the room, the sound in the room, and just suddenly like all of the elements coming together in that moment was a kind of, there was a flow to it, you know, you'll hear about it in sports, you hear it in all kinds of areas. People talk about that moment of flow, that moment when everything kind of finds ease and is delivered. That was the experience that we had that moment. And it was a very important one for me. I never did forget that again, you know, like I was taught, I know that's real. You know, however unsure I may have become of myself in the future, I was aware that there is an experience to be had that is very real, and that is deep and meaningful, and that it's not found by how well you play. It's not found by technical virtuosity. It's a combination of many different factors, and in many ways, it's as much psychological, artistic, spiritual, if you like. You know, there are many things involved in making a moment of beauty, you know, other than just simply being able to play your instrument. And for the rest of my life, I've kind of tried to, you know, work on myself, you know, be that person, like show up in that moment, ready for that moment, you know, that has been more important for me than, you know, which reels am I playing, and, you know, what kind of fiddle do I have, and which bow do I have, or, you know, like, it could be any of those things. Like the moment can be created out of humble ingredients sometimes, you know.
Beautifully expressed. Thank you for that. Well, that seems like a great place to close out. I could talk to you all day, but I won't keep you. Did you want to play one more tune, or are you happy with that?
I'll play something for you for sure, yeah. And great. Let me see now. Maybe you have something I should play. Maybe you're thinking of something now.
I didn't make a list, and I can't pronounce a lot of the,
that's okay,
the
no
Irish.
Problem. No problem at all.
What was that?
The Quilca Mountains. And it was written by a fiddle player by the name of Ed Reavy, who spent most of his life in, he's from Cavan, but lived all his life really in Philadelphia. Hmm. Wrote a lot of very beautiful fiddle tunes.
Well, it was a real honor meeting you today and hearing about your perspectives. Thanks so much.
Well, Leah, thank you very much, and great to meet you. And And I hope that the sound and everything is okay for you and that it'll all work out.
I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Thanks for following the series on your favorite podcast player and sharing your favorite episodes with your friends, all of which help find new listeners. I have lots more episodes coming in this season 3 with a fascinating diversity of musicians and their stories and music. Have a great week. Please consider either buying me a virtual coffee as a tip or becoming a monthly supporter starting at $3 Canadian, which is close to $2 US or €2, and getting access to unique perks. The link is in the description.